At the heart of Christianity is belief in the hypostatic union. The second person of the Trinity, the Son or the Word, took a human nature to himself in such a way that divinity and humanity are united in one person or hypostasis, that hypostasis being none other than the second person himself. To say this is one thing, to understand it is another. And the theology of the hypostatic union is the attempt to understand it. It's not easy. Indeed, there's an important sense in which it can't be done. The hypostatic union, like other theological mysteries, is beyond human comprehension. To be sure, it can be understood to a certain degree, but it cannot be fully grasped. Both halves of what I just said are crucial in what follows. When talking about the hypostatic union, theologians often use similitudes. They say that the hypostatic union is like something else. That they do this is obvious enough, but what is perhaps less obvious is what is really going on when they do, and what should be going on. Similitudes might seem to be mere decorations, a way to pretty up our scientific accounts. But when you see Richard Cross take Thomas Aquinas to the woodshed for the way he handles a similitude, you start thinking that there's more at stake than simply making theology more fun to read. According to Cross, Aquinas uses, as a similitude for the hypostatic union of humanity and divinity, the union of a concrete part and the whole it belongs to. The point of this similitude, Cross says, is that concrete parts do not describe... The point of this similitude, Cross says, is that concrete parts do not contribute any esse, any existence, to the wholes to which they belong, even as the assumed human nature does not contribute any esse to Christ. But the reason concrete parts do not do this, says Cross, is that they belong to the essence of their wholes. Therefore, use of this similitude leads to the view that Christ's assumed human nature belongs to the divine essence, which is another way of saying that use of this similitude leads to monophysitism, a view condemned by the Council of Chalcedon in 451. Now, of course, Cross knows that Aquinas is against monophysitism. So what he says in the end is that Aquinas lands in contradiction. In my view, this does not amount to a very worrisome attack. One reason why not is that it is all based on texts on Christ's esse, where, in my humble opinion, Aquinas isn't at his Thomistic best. That, however, is another tale for another time. What I want to focus on this afternoon is the very question of interpreting a similitude. I think Cross's criticism of Aquinas grows out of a misunderstanding of how Aquinas uses similitudes, and out of a misunderstanding of how similitudes ought to be used. In this paper, I will look at some writings of Thomas Aquinas, but also at some writings of John Duns Scotus, and I will make observations that are both historical and systematic. As far as historical observations go, I will try to make clear how Aquinas and Scotus use similitudes in their treatment of the hypostatic union, and in particular, how they deal with the two similitudes that have received the most attention in recent literature. My historical conclusion will be that they are not that far apart. While they may indeed be friendly rivals, they are more friendly than rivals, at least on this issue. Having made that point, I will switch to a more systematic register and discuss how similitudes ought to be used in discussions of theological topics such as the hypostatic union. Let's start with Aquinas. He uses quite a few similitudes in discussing the hypostatic union. Sometimes they are very explicit, as when he says outright that one thing is like another. Other times they are implicit, as when he brings up one thing in the context of discussing another, in a way that makes it obvious that there's supposed to be some sort of similarity. Here is an incomplete list. Aquinas compares the hypostatic union to the union of soul and body. He compares it to the union between a human being and the garment he is wearing. He compares it to the union between a human being and his or her sensitive powers. He compares it to the union between the soul and the resurrected body. He compares it to the relationship between God and those who are sons of God by grace. He compares it to the union of several accidental natures in some creature. He compares it to the union of the members of a body to the body. Relatedly, he says the assumed nature is like a member of a body. He compares it to the union between an accident and a subject, such as Socrates and his wisdom. Scotus, by contrast, seems to be less inclined to the use of similitudes. We think of Aquinas as an austere writer, and rightly so, but for spareness, austerity, verbal asceticism, and general lack of metaphor and imagery, Scotus leaves Aquinas in the dust. In Scotus's writings on the topic, I find two similitudes, or maybe one and a half. First, this is the half similitude, he compares the assumed human nature to a stone. A stone has a natural aptitude for being on the ground, an aptitude that can be overcome if we hold it up in the air. Likewise, the assumed nature has an unfulfilled or blocked aptitude for being an independent person. This is not exactly a similitude for the hypostatic union itself, but for the assumed nature. But we could make it into one if we liked. Second, Scotus compares the relationship between the assumed human nature and the word to the relation between an accident and its subject. And indeed, this is pretty clearly his favorite similitude. At one point, he even says, and now I'm quoting, "There is no union similar to the union of one nature to a person of another nature, except for the union of an accident to its subject." So it's fairly blunt. Two prominent scholars of medieval theology, Marilyn McCord Adams and Richard Cross, already mentioned, have focused attention on just two similitudes, the whole part similitude, the one I started with, and the subject accident similitude, the one just mentioned. Further, they both associate Aquinas with the whole part model and Scotus with the subject accident model. In fact, that the contrast between those two models is one of the structuring principles of Cross's book. As we shall see, the situation is considerably more complicated than this suggests, although to be fair to Adams and Cross, they are aware of at least some of these complications. For the rest of this talk, I am going to focus only on these two similitudes. I do this with a bit of a guilty conscience, because at one point in the Summa Contra Gentiles, Aquinas says that the best similitude is neither of these, but instead the union of soul and body. But when he discusses the hypostatic union in the Summa Theologiae, he doesn't seem to give this similitude much more importance than any other, as far as I can tell. So mostly I'm going to just overcome this scruple and proceed as already mentioned. It facilitates the kind of connection that our conference is interested in. It makes it easier to compare Aquinas and Scotus. And further, again, these are the ones that Cross and Adams have stressed. So, we'll start with what Aquinas says about whole and part. The idea, roughly, is that Christ is like a whole, and the assumed nature is like one of his parts. Making the case of Christ and his assumed nature similar to that of Socrates and, let's say, one of his hands. As mentioned already, Cross presents this as being tied to the question of whether there is in Christ more than one existence, more than one esse. And Adam's does so as well. She does it first, actually. Indeed, when Adam says that SCOTUS does not accept this model, the reason she gives is precisely that SCOTUS has a more general disagreement with Aquinas on the question of esse. Now, the first thing I want to say about the whole part similitude is this. It is found in Aquinas' Christology independently of discussions having to do with Christ's esse. Say nothing for the moment about the esse question, then. Let me make the general observation that on the most basic level, the similitude works as follows. In both the case of Socrates' hand and the case of Christ's assumed humanity, we have something that is less than some whole. There's more to Socrates than his hand, and likewise, there's more to Christ than his human nature. On this basis, you might think that the relation of whole and part is not a mere similitude, but in fact, an altogether sober description. The complete Christ, God and man, is a whole of which the assumed human nature is a part. But in fact, Aquinas denies that, because to him, a part is something that is by nature incomplete, whereas Christ's human nature is complete. To us, I think, this probably sounds like a quibble. Even if Aquinas uses the Latin word pars to indicate something that is incomplete by nature, we do not use the English word part like that. We have no problem saying, for instance, that someone is part of a team. To do so does not insinuate that the person in question is metaphysically incomplete. So over-focusing on the word part doesn't seem productive. After all, the point can be put without the language of parts by speaking, for example, of constituents. Just as Socrates' hand is one of his constituents, so too Christ's human nature is one of his constituents. So now we have the problem posed without using the word part. The similitude goes farther, in fact, as we can see by considering the following two related points. First, both the hand and the human nature belong in some sense to the genus of substance. Second, despite this, neither of them is a freestanding substance. Neither is a subsisting hypostasis or person. The second point, that neither is a subsisting hypostasis, seems clear enough. But the first needs explanation and, indeed, qualification. For Aquinas, both the hand and the humanity belong to the genus of substance, yes, but they belong to it per reductione, by reduction. They are not accidents, but they aren't substances either. Rather than subsisting, they serve as principles or constituents in virtue of which substances subsist. Should we say that the relationship between Socrates and his hand is exactly like the relationship between Christ and his humanity? No. Even though both the hand and the humanity belong to the genus of substance, there is a very important difference between them. Christ's human nature does not ground a human person, but it is the sort of principle that could do so. That makes it very different from Socrates' hand, which not only doesn't ground a human nature, but also cannot ground a human nature. Let me sum up what I've said about Aquinas on the part-whole similitude, insofar as that similitude is not tied up with the question of Christ's esse. Even if part isn't the right word to use here, there is a similarity between the hand-Socrates relation and the humanity-Christ relation, inasmuch as each is a case of a relationship that holds between a constituent and the larger composite that it helps to constitute. Further, in both cases, the constituents belong, by reduction, to the genus of substance. At the same time, however, there's an important difference between the cases. In only one of these cases is the constituent the sort of thing that could have grounded an independent person? As noted already, Aquinas also uses the part-whole similitude when discussing Christ's essay. In particular, he does so in passages where he is arguing that Christ has only one essay. For reasons that I have set forth elsewhere, I think that this issue is far more complicated than is usually realized. And furthermore, I think that the places where Aquinas says that Christ has more than one essay, make better sense, Thomistically speaking. Setting as much of that aside as I can, let me say the following. When Aquinas says that Christ has only one essay, his main concern is to say that Christ has only one subsistence, one existence as an independent hypostasis. Otherwise, he wouldn't be one person. That's his main concern. If that's right, then when he says that the relation of Socrates' hand to Socrates is like the relation of Christ's humanity to Christ, and when he explains the similarity in terms of the fact that neither constituent contributes esse to its respective whole, he, Aquinas, need not mean anything more than the following. Neither the hand nor the humanity serves as a principle in virtue of which Christ is a subsisting person. In other words, he, Aquinas, need not mean that the hand-Socrates relation and the humanity-Christ relation are alike in every respect. In particular, he, Aquinas, need not mean that just as the hand is joined to Socrates in a union of nature, so too is the humanity joined to Socrates in a union. Well, start over. In particular, he, Aquinas, need not mean that just as the hand is joined to Socrates in a union of nature, so too is the humanity joined to Christ in a union of nature. He need not mean that. That business about union in nature might, in fact, be one of the ways in which the similitude is unlike the thing that it is a similitude for. So the thought that using this similitude is flirting with monophysitism makes sense only on the assumption that Aquinas thinks that the similitude goes very, very far, and perhaps even all the way. But that is a very large assumption. It's not only a large assumption, it's a false one. For Aquinas, you should expect the similitude is not only like the thing it's a similitude for, but also unlike it. Therefore, you should expect the thing that it's a similitude for to have only some of the characteristics of the similitude, and not all of them. Or is that cheating? I mean, is it cheating to use a similitude, and then when a point of dissimilarity arises, to say, oh, but I don't mean it like that? This thought reminds me of that clever saying that one sometimes hears, that an argument isn't like a bus that you can get off anytime you want. Unlike a bus, an argument must be taken all the way to the end. That's clever, and it's true as well, but here's the thing. A similitude isn't an argument. It's a similitude. And it's in the nature of a similitude that it's going to be partly like the thing that it's a similitude for and partly unlike it. In fact, quoting a text from John of Damascus, a text that I will myself quote near the end, Aquinas says that if a similitude wasn't at least somewhat different from the thing that it's a similitude for, it wouldn't be a similitude at all. To wrap up this discussion of the whole part similitude, even when Aquinas uses the similitude to explore the question of Christ's essay, there is just no good reason to pin on him the view that the reason why the assumed nature contributes no essay is that, like the hand, it's one in nature with what it is joined to. That one in nature business might be, and indeed has to be, one of the dissimilar aspects. To saddle Aquinas with monophysitism on the basis of the fact that he uses the whole part similitude is to misunderstand how similitudes work. Now let's turn our attention to SCOTUS and the whole part similitude. I think it's correct to say that SCOTUS doesn't use the whole part similitude for the hypostatic union. I haven't seen it, anyway. But is there a reason to think that he couldn't do so, because doing so would violate some principle of his? I think it would not violate any principle of his. First, insofar as the similitude is not tied up with the question of Christ's essay, its point is only that the assumed humanity is like a hand insofar as it's a constituent that's less than the whole. I can't see any reason why SCOTUS wouldn't agree to that, as long as we didn't literally say that the assumed human nature was a part rather than a nature. There is one place in the Lectura where he says, well, it's not a part. Okay. Not. Second, what about the times when Aquinas uses the similitude in conjunction with the discussion of Christ's essay? Adams, as you will recall, thinks that there's a problem in principle with SCOTUS using the similitude, at least in that sort of context. Because for Aquinas, all the constituents of a substance share in one essay, whereas for SCOTUS, each constituent has its own essay. Or to put it a bit more carefully, or anyway, a bit more cagely, for Aquinas, all the substantial constituents that are themselves in the genus of substance share in one essay, while for SCOTUS, each has its own essay. But Aquinas is more flexible than this picture might suggest. He would certainly agree that all the substantial constituents of substance share in the same subsistence. But he is not entirely resistant to saying that constituents have their own existences in some secondary sense of that word. So I suspect that with a bit of patience, we could get Aquinas and SCOTUS to agree on this point, at least to a significant extent. I conclude that while SCOTUS doesn't use this similitude, there's little that stands in the way of his doing so if he wanted to. He just didn't want to. So much for the discussion of the part-whole similitude. Now let's turn to the accident-subject similitude. The basic idea is obviously that the relation between the word and the assumed human nature is akin to the relation between the subject of an accident and that accident. Adams and Cross treat this as SCOTUS's favorite similitude, and since, as we have already seen, SCOTUS himself endorses the similitude very strongly, it makes sense to let SCOTUS speak first this time. SCOTUS discusses this similitude in no fewer than four places: the Reportatio Parisiensis, the Ordinatio, the Lectura, and the 19th Quadlibet. There are small differences among these texts. The differences, while not without interest, aren't important here. What's important instead is the following composite sketch. For SCOTUS, in the case of an accident and its subject, there are two elements: a causal relation, according to which the subject is the cause of the accident, and a dependence relation, according to which the accident depends on the subject. And these two relations happen together, but they are still different from one another. What's more, the dependence relation is prior to, more fundamental than, the causal relation, which means that, at least in theory, you could have the dependence relation without having the causal relation. What you could have in theory is what you do in fact get in the case of the hypostatic union. The assumed human nature depends on the word, but the hypostatic union is not a causal relation. It's not a relation of material causality, because a divine person cannot possibly be the material cause of anything. And it's not a relation of efficient causality either, because the efficient cause of the assumed nature is not the word alone, but the three divine persons acting together as creator. So, does Scotus think that the accident-subject relation is a good similitude or a good model for the hypostatic union? It depends on what that question means. If it means, does he think that the two unions are similar in one way and dissimilar in another, then yes. But it's equally clear that he would reject any suggestion that the two are alike in every way. What about Aquinas, who allegedly rejects the similitude? He doesn't discuss it very much, and most of what he says is in his sentences commentary. There are two important respects in which, for Aquinas, the hypostatic union is not like the union of accident and subject. First, God can't have accidents, so therefore he can't be related to the assumed nature in the way that a subject is related to an accident. Second, independently of that, a human nature is a substantial nature, not an accidental nature. So therefore, the assumed nature can't be related to God in the way that an accident is related to a subject. On that basis, you might think it best to say that Aquinas rejects this similitude in every possible way. But you'd be wrong. He says that the assumed nature is similar to an accident, and I think it's safe to infer that he would agree on that basis that the relation between the word and the assumed nature is similar to the relation between a subject and an accident. Similar how? First, the assumed nature, like any accident, is posterior to the establishment or constitution of what it belongs to. Just as Socrates' very existence is prior to his having wisdom or any other accident, so the word's very existence is prior to his having humanity. As Aquinas puts it, accidents and the assumed humanity come after the relevant hypostasis has its complete existence. That's his way of putting that. Second, beyond this general similarity of the hypostatic union to any subject-accident relation, there is a more specific similarity to the particular category habitus. Unlike the usual case of an accident, where the accident is something inhering in the subject, in the case of habitus, we have what amounts to a substantial being. I'm going like this because there's questions about whether the standard examples are actually substantial. So we have what amounts to a kind of sort of substantial being, like a garment, that is related to the subject. Think of Socrates wearing his chiton. This wearing a chiton accident amounts to a relation between Socrates and his chiton. And the similarity goes a bit further. The chiton is modified and elevated by being taken on by Socrates, just as the human nature is modified and elevated by being taken on by Christ. Of course, the human nature isn't just like a chiton, because the chiton is sort of a freestanding substance, whereas the human nature is not. It belongs to the category of substance only per dictionem, as we saw earlier. This is closely related to something we saw earlier, namely Aquinas' idea that the assumed nature, but not a chiton, is joined to the complete essay of the word. Perhaps we could put it like this. Although Christ, in virtue of the incarnation, does not come to subsist, he does come to have a nature in virtue of which something could subsist. By contrast, when Socrates puts on his chiton, he thereby neither comes to subsist nor even to have a nature in virtue of which something could subsist. Nothing can subsist in virtue of wearing clothing. In this crucial sense, clothes do not make the man. So Aquinas, like Scotus, thinks that the union between accident and subject is like the hypostatic union in some ways, but not in others. Do Aquinas and Scotus agree on the points of similarity and difference? They don't mention all the same points, But on the other hand, I think it's clear that they would agree on all of them if they sat down together and talked it through. To begin with the dissimilarities, Scotus mentions two points of dissimilarity: that the hypostatic union does not involve an actualization of potency in the word, and that the assumed nature isn't efficiently caused only by the person it is joined to. Aquinas states the former, and I'm confident he would accept the latter. I was looking around. I haven't found a place where he just says it, but he says, I think he would accept the latter. Aquinas mentions two points of dissimilarity: that the hypostatic union does not involve an actualization of anything in the word, we just discussed that one, and that the human nature is not an accidental type of nature. Scotus doesn't mention this second point when discussing the similitude of the accident, but obviously he would accept it. Now let's talk about the similarities. Scotus mentions one point of similarity, that the assumed nature depends on the word. Aquinas does not say this when talking about the accident similitude, but I think he would agree. For example, Aquinas holds that the human nature, once assumed into a unity of person with the Son, cannot be removed from that union. And he clearly thinks that the assumed nature is the junior partner in that union. So those two together seem sufficient for dependence. Aquinas mentions two points of similarity. First, the assumed nature and accidents are both posterior to the complete being of what they belong to. Second, the union of assumed nature to word is, like the case of a garment to a man, a case when something in the genus of substance is joined to a pre-existing substance. Scotus mentions neither of these points when talking about the accident similitude, but I think it's safe to say that he would accept them. To conclude this comparison between Aquinas and Scotus on the subject accident similitude, they agree in saying that there is some similarity to the case of the hypostatic union, and they also agree that there is some dissimilarity involved. Some of the items on their lists of similarity and difference overlap, and in no case are their lists incompatible. In short, they're pretty friendly on this point. To conclude my historical remarks, let me say what I hope will by now not surprise you. Rather than seeing Scotus as the guy who adopts the subject accident model and Aquinas as the guy who adopts the whole part model, it's better to see each thinker as able to endorse each of them in part, but only in part. The differences are in the details and are likely to be matters of mere happenstance of what points they happened to have made in the writings that we happen to have, rather than being points of philosophical or theological principle. And indeed, there's something to be said for making use of both similitudes. The accident similitude directs our attention to the fact that the assumed human nature does not give rise to a new person. That's important, right? Otherwise, you're a Nestorian. Aquinas might say that this is because the assumed nature comes after the words complete being, while Scotus might say that it's because it comes after the words primary being. This similitude helps us to focus on the unity of Christ's person. Meanwhile, the whole part similitude, at least insofar as it mentions parts that come from the genus of substance, directs our attention to the fact that Christ's becoming human is an event on the level of the substantial, not on the level of the accidental. This similitude helps us to focus on the full integrity of Christ's humanity. It's not just some accident. So the first similitude, again, helps us to avoid Nestorianism, and the second one helps us to avoid Monophysitism. Those are the two big things you've got to avoid. For the rest of this paper, I want to switch from the historical mode to what theologians call the systematic mode, making claims not about what certain historical figures have thought to be the case, but instead about what is in fact the case. Of course, I mean what is in fact the case about the right way to use theological similitudes. I will build on what Aquinas and Scotus do because I find their approach very helpful. Let's begin by talking about what similitudes are not to be used for. Similitudes cannot give us the content of a theological doctrine. Indeed, you have to already know the content of the doctrine in order to know how to use the similitude correctly. And this is because a similitude is only partly similar. It's hard to do better than to quote a remark about theological similitudes from John of Damascus. I mentioned this earlier. In a discussion of the Incarnation, after using some interesting similitudes that involve cutting a sunlit tree with an axe and pouring water on flaming steel, John of Damascus says, one must not take the parallels too absolutely and strictly. Indeed, in parallels, it's a paradigma, one must consider both what is the same and what is altered. Otherwise, it would not be a parallel. For if they were the same in all respects, they would be identities and not parallels. And all the more so in dealing with divine matters. The Incarnation is unique. If you found something that was exactly like it, it would just be the Incarnation all over again, and not something else. For this reason, the idea of fully assimilating the Incarnation to anything else is a non-starter from the very start. If someone uses a certain similitude for a unique theological mystery, but then his full account of that mystery ends up deviating from the terms of the similitude, this is not grounds for saying that the account has failed. In fact, it's a necessary condition of the accounts having succeeded. Only necessary, of course. So much for being negative. Now let's be positive. I want to mention three things that you can do with a similitude. First, you can make a certain doctrine clearer to others and to yourself by working through the comparisons and the contrasts. Take the hypostatic union or some other mystery and then set it next to something else, a different theological mystery or a created reality such as the union of subject and accident or the union of soul and body or whatever. Then think through the ways in which they are similar and the ways in which they are different. This process gives you an organized set of questions to ask, and the result will be a clearer, sharper, less vague understanding of the mystery. And do note that the points of dissimilarity are not just noise that we need to filter out in order to get to the signal of similarity. It's all signal. The way in which, for example, the hypostatic union is like the union of subject and accident is signal. And so, too, is the way in which these are unlike. A further use of similitudes is not in theological reflection proper, but in teaching. Let's say you are the teacher of a college student or a preschooler, whatever. You, let's hope, understand the doctrine in question, keeping in mind that no one comprehends the doctrine. The student, just because he is a student, can be assumed not to understand it as well, or even at all. Well, you can use a similitude to bring the student closer to where he needs to be. You might say, Socrates can acquire wisdom while remaining the person he was before, right? Well, God can acquire humanity while remaining the person he was before. It's a little bit like that. If the student understands what it means to acquire wisdom, then, since understanding the acquisition of wisdom is a mental operation similar to that of understanding the words becoming incarnate, the teacher will have gotten the student to engage in a mental operation similar to the one he would have to engage in to understand the incarnation. Now, when using a similitude in this way, the focus is on the similarities. And it takes a prudent teacher to know when talking about the dissimilarities will be helpful, when such talk will be more signal, and when it will be just be noise that confuses the student. It requires a judgment call based above all on the student's own level of understanding. As we've all no doubt learned the hard way, giving students more can be a way of giving them less. More light makes things more visible, but only to a point. On the other hand, if you don't mention the dissimilarities, you might be setting a time bomb. The student may later draw inferences that you didn't want him to draw. Teaching, like almost everything else, is dangerous. I have one last point. I fear it's a small point, perhaps Euclideanly so. I want to suggest that similarities can play the following role in theological thinking. They can serve as pro-examples. It's like the opposite of a counter-example, right? They can serve as pro-examples that demonstrate the possibility of satisfying a certain necessary condition of the theological mysteries being true. That was a very long-winded phrase. I'll read it again. They can demonstrate, they're pro-examples that demonstrate the possibility of satisfying a certain necessary condition of a theological mysteries being true. An example or two might make that clearer. The incarnation is true only if it is possible for something to be joined to a pre-existing person in a unity of person while not being joined to that person in a unity of nature. That's a necessary condition of the mysteries being true. Now, if we can find, outside the theology of the incarnation, an example of this happening, then we will have shown that one necessary condition has been satisfied. Well, it's easy. A color or a bit of knowledge can be added to a person in a unity of person without being added to him in a unity of nature. So pointing to a case of a subject-accident union shows that one necessary condition of the hypothetic unions being true can, in fact, be satisfied. Here's another example. A necessary condition of the incarnations being true is that it's possible for something from the genus of substance to be joined to a person in a unity of person. Can we find an example? Sure thing. You can add a kidney or a hand to someone in a unity of person. So again, you have shown that a necessary condition can be satisfied. Now, of course, to show that a necessary condition of something's being true can be satisfied is not to show that that something is true. After all, a necessary condition is only a necessary condition. I mean, you won't even have shown that the whole thing is even possible. And the ways in which these similitudes show conditions that are necessary but not sufficient is precisely the ways in which these similitudes are dissimilar from the things that they are similitudes of. So this third use of similitudes doesn't get us very far. But remember, in theology, not very far is, generally speaking, as far as you get. It's better than getting nowhere at all. All right, one last thing. Or just a conclusion. I've talked about how Aquinas and Scotus use similitudes in their discussions of the hypostatic union, and I've gone on to indicate how we might do the same. Much of what I have said could be applied mutatis mutandis to other theological mysteries. My final word might just be this. We should always keep in mind that in our quest for understanding, there will be things that we don't understand. Although to say this is to point to a limit on our understanding, at the same time, it's not necessary to feel entirely bad about it. Understanding what we don't understand is itself a form of understanding. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Garman. We have time for some questions. Father Hofer.
Thank you very much, Dr. Garman. I was thinking about the patristic traditions of Dionysius and Augustine. I'd like to ask a question particularly about Augustine and similitude as it relates also to the first presentation of the day concerning theology as affective.
Okay.
And so in the De Doctrina Christiana, Augustine talks about scripture's images. And he has a particular image where he says, you know, why does scripture say this? I find it delightful. So I'm wondering, in terms of similitudes, have you come across any instance of a similitude where, particularly in terms of thinking about the hypostatic union, that there's a function about the delightful? And to go to your concluding comment, you know, not feel entirely bad.
Right. I did say that.
So in terms of
yes.
thinking about feeling some sort of delight or some sort of joy or that first person response in terms of precisely giving an image. What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I'd want to look at what these authors have to say about why scripture uses metaphors and stuff like that. I mean, I have to recheck that stuff to see if that particular point gets made. Maybe you already know that it does or doesn't. Maybe you're laying a trap for me. But I'm teasing. So what I'm tempted to say is that it's true that some of these similitudes can be delightful. And, of course, there's something a bit idiosyncratic about that, right? It depends on what kind of person you are. Like, some people would say, like, wow, the hypostatic union is a little bit like cutting a tree, a sunlit tree with an axe. Like, that's amazing. And other people go, whoa, it's like the subject-accident relation. Now, that's a little bit more arcane, you know. You have to be more philosophically minded. But there are actually people in this world who take delight in the incommensurability of the diagonal with the side. So, right? So it's a little bit relative to your audience. But here's the thought I have. Maybe this is a little bit censorious sounding. I'm tempted to say that it's good if what you delight in is understanding the mystery better. But if the similitude is just really cool, then you're starting to get distracted. It's a little bit like, I mean, I feel like I'm making an Augustinian remark. You're glaring at me for being so censorious. But this is, right, look, think about Augustine's remarks about music in church, right? There are times when you're just like, man, I love this tune. And like, that's maybe not the best moment in the liturgy. So there's a question of getting carried away, I think, and doing stuff that's really fun. But on the other hand, back to being a little bit less puritanical or whatever, if you can make it fun and interesting and delightful and it holds the reader's or the listener's attention, that's a good thing. Now, so then one more thought I have, though, is just as I'm speaking, is there a way, I don't know, this makes me nervous, but where you're explaining some theological truth or something, and then you give some metaphor, similitude, and it's delightful. Well, is there some chance that sort of the delight in the metaphor will transfer over and they'll start taking delight in the mystery? And now you've sort of tricked people into being more delighted by divine things, which would be a good thing. Although, it's a little slightly done by trickery. I don't know whether it's okay or not. I mean, I'm just making this up right now. I don't know, do you?
No, that's fine. It's good. Thank you.
Dr. Gorman,
yes.
That was fascinating. I have two questions. One question and one observation. The question is, does Thomas Aquinas in the Christology reflect on similitudes? Or do we have to take for granted that he takes the ideas he's doing in the first question of the Summa Theologiae when he asks whether theology is metaphorical?
Mm-hmm.
Does he take that idea into these dogmatic questions? And the observation is that what you said is Thomas exactly doing in the biblical commentaries when he explains the mystery of God? And he says the task of the interpreter is exactly to take the anthropomorphic formulations, pictures, mm-hmm. similitudes of the Bible, and explain it as similitudes.
Okay.
And say, under what aspect is this picture fitting and what is not fitting? So this is a very pedagogical, exegetical
yeah.
Practice he's actually doing.
Where... Do you know offhand like which commentary he says that
Job.
On?
Job. In any
in Job,
any,
okay, yeah.
Any commentaries when he speaks about God, he said the ire of God, the arm of God,
right, right.
God's wrath.
Yeah.
And he says, well, God is not a person; he is
yeah.
the wrath. But what does it mean?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's
that, but not that.
Right. That would be especially important in the Job commentary, I would think. Yeah, the one I know best is Philippians, and I'm. So that's a good idea to just connect this material with remarks he makes in the biblical commentaries. Does he reflect on this in a sort of second order way, especially in the Christological material? I think the answer is not very often, but sometimes. And it's precisely where he uses that John of Damascus quote. So I forget exactly now. I have to double check what the context is. But sometimes he'll bring up some similitude. It might even be when he's talking about subject and accident. I'm not sure. And then he'll say, or when he's responding to, this is how it goes. I'm pretty sure now this is the context. He's responding to an objection. And the objector goes too far with the similitude. And then Aquinas says in the reply, look, it's a similitude. Remember what John of Damascus says. So in that way, he's sort of reflecting in a second-order way. He doesn't make a big deal out of it. I don't think there's a whole article anywhere in the Christology. But it does show up once or twice, like that. I think that's right.
Dr. Gorman, if I can use the moderator's privilege to ask my own question. I have a lot of questions, actually, and I would love to talk at much greater length, because this is a subject I love, and I loved your paper. Thank you very much. So I'll just ask what I think is maybe the most interesting question for this context. Could you highlight, you highlighted this, the similitudes between Scotus and Aquinas in a certain sense, in the way that they use the similitudes. Are there important differences between their accounts of the hypostatic union that we should also keep in mind? I'm thinking, now, I don't know...
What a little rivalry.
Well, I don't know the complete
yeah.
answer to that.
Right.
I know Aquinas' theory much better than I know Scotus's. There's one subject that I have studied between the two of them, and I was very interested to discover that for Aquinas, the habitual grace of Christ, this would be like the virtues, the supernatural and other virtues, human qualities that Christ has... he thinks that these are a necessary outflow from the hypostatic union. They're really distinct from it, but they're necessarily entailed by it. Whereas Scotus specifically denies that position.
Right.
And says that, no, you could just... The hypostatic union is just this relation, or the union, and doesn't entail anything further with respect to the humanity of Christ. So that seems to me to be actually a very major difference between
yeah.
them. Although maybe it's not just about the hypostatic, but could you comment?
Yeah, no, that's right. I mean, for Scotus, you could, in theory, have a hypostatic union, but there wouldn't be, Christ wouldn't have the beatific vision and all that stuff. All of the issues where I've sort of tried to dig down into the nuts and bolts metaphysical stuff, I find they're usually closer... more similar than dissimilar, just on the precise issues of sort of the mechanical, you know, the sort of metaphysical nuts and bolts of how the hypostatic union itself works. Even in places where it looks like they disagree, it turns out they kind of don't. So, for example, like sometimes the differences are only verbal. So Aquinas will say that that Christ does not get esse simpliciter, how do you want to translate that? Sort of like plain old being or just unqualified being, doesn't get that from his human nature. And Scotus says, yes, he does. And so a lot of Thomists have said, you see, I always knew Scotus was a Nestorian. But if you like look at what Scotus actually says, he says, well, but when I say esse simpliciter, I just mean substantial. Of course, what but there's still something that Christ doesn't receive from his human nature, and that's the primary being. And then Scotus actually says this is a verbal dispute. So sometimes like they're quite conflicting verbally, but they really are saying more or less the same thing. But there's a really famous case, and Franciscans really like this one, I think. Or I shouldn't say that. Some Franciscans do. I don't want to generalize too much. But this question about the motive of the incarnation. This is like an old saw. So, for Aquinas asks, if man had not sinned, would God have become incarnate anyway? And he says, well, the only reason we know anything about this is from Scripture. And in Scripture, the answer is always put in terms of a remedy for sin. And so you think he's going to say, so that's all I know. But he actually goes a little farther. He says, really, that's what we should say. That's the thing to say. But for Scotus, it's really clear that's not right. Even if man had not fallen, we still would have had the incarnation. And that's one example of this sort of general argumentative principle that people find in Scotus, which is the dequid, potuit, fecit, right? It was fitting. He could have done it. He did it. If you go to Cologne and see Scotus's sarcophagus, he's like holding a little book. I mean, there's an image of him carved into there's an image of him carved into the lid, and he's holding a little book, and that's what it says. It's very nice. And some people have made a really big whoop about this. I'm a little skeptical of this kind of way of making a big whoop out of it, but this is part of like the whole big Franciscan thing. Everything's Christ-centered, blah, blah, blah. I'm not really sure whether that's the case, but certainly they disagree on this, and it seems like an important question.
Thank you very much, Dr. Gorman. I'd really like to ask about the instrumentality of Christ's nature. So when Thomas explains how the human nature is the same thing then for sacramental causality, it seems that the primary agent achieves its proper effect through the proper operation of the instrument, right? But it seems that there is also a very important difference, which is that in the case of both Christ's humanity and the sacraments, the proper effect of the instrument does not serve as a material cause for that which is the proper effect of the primary agent, which is what we see in the similitudes that Thomas uses, like the saw or an axe, or when we use, I don't know, a marker. But Thomas is willing to call that an instrument.
Yes.
And not, he doesn't talk about it as if it's a similitude. The instrumentality is a similitude for this relationship, but he actually calls the humanity an instrument. So I haven't seen him discuss the difference.
Okay.
Yeah.
If I understand what you're asking, you're saying that like a saw is an instrument, but Christ's humanity, or in the sacraments, we have things that Aquinas calls instruments. But there's an important difference between them having to do with this material causation business. And therefore, when he uses the word instrument there, is that too a similitude? Is that your question?
Not exactly.
Okay.
When Thomas, and whether in the Summa or in the De Veritate, when he's describing how we can talk about the sacraments or Christ's human nature as an instrument, as within this order of efficient causality, he explains that we can call it an instrument because of this relationship, the fact that by the proper action of the instrument, the primary agent acts. But there still seems to be important differences
yes.
between any example of an instrument that we know and that thus Thomas's justification and Christ's humanity is related to the divine action.
Yeah.
My question is, how is this situation in which Thomas, based on this, dare I say, logical univocity, why is he willing to call it an instrument rather than say it's like an instrument? When in all these other cases we've seen, Thomas is not willing to just say,
right.
to apply the name.
Good. Okay, so, short answer, I don't know. And what I'm not clear on is whether there's something substantive at stake here or not, which is in a way another way of putting your question, I think. In other words, what you could sort of imagine that Aquinas might have done something like this. He might have said, is the subject, is the humanity word relation an example of an accident-subject relation? And he might have said, well, subject-accident relation is said in two ways. The first way, and then just explain what we would all call a subject-accident relation. And then the other would be to say, well, you know, what if you have something from a substantial genus, blah, 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 and add all that stuff and go, in the second way. Now, what's the difference between that? What's the substantive difference between saying that and saying, no, it's not a subject-accident relation, but it's kind of like it? I think in some cases, there is no difference. It's just a terminological choice that somebody makes. And no doubt, someone later will come along with a different set of terminological presuppositions and get really angry and call that first person a heretic over what's in just a verbal difference. Now, there are some constraints on this, though, because it's not entirely... You can't just use any word any way you... I mean, okay, sorry, you can use any word any way you want, but sometimes it's a really, really bad idea. So that's one of... So there are constraints on this. I would think that primarily the constraint is just that pragmatic one. You don't want to be misunderstood. I think it has something to do with... Like, words like substance and accident are technical philosophical words. They tend to have pretty well-defined meanings already. And so then when you come along and say, well, there's actually two meanings to that, in one way, you could say, why not? It's already a technical word. But on the other hand, everybody already has a fairly clear idea of what it means. But an instrument... It's a kind of loosey-goosey word to begin with because it's an everyday word. So maybe there's a little bit more scope for using it in this kind of analogous and maybe even similitudinous, metaphorical-ish way. I'm just sort of talking around your question. I think it's a really good question, and I don't know... At the moment, I don't think that there's, like, a sharp answer, that it's just this pragmatic thing. But I could be wrong. I don't know. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Professor Berman, for a great talk. Thinking about the subject of the conference, people sometimes say that Franciscans are more poetic and Dominicans are more, in terms of theologians.
Right, right. Right.
Franciscans are more poetic.
Right.
And Dominicans are more hard-edged.
Right.
Cold, rational, analyst types.
Yeah.
But it's interesting that between Aquinas and Scotus,
yeah.
in this question of similitudes, Aquinas uses similitudes much more than Scotus does. So if we could broaden the conversation, or at least the scope, do we want to make more general statements about Dominicans as hard-nosed rational sorts and Franciscan as poetic, kind of talking about the trees and
the flowers and all that. Yeah.
Or do we need to say, oh no, this is just one particular thinker of the Franciscan tradition or school or family or whatever, vice versa for the Dominicans. I kind of have a thought, maybe following from something either Monsignor Whipple said yesterday or Professor Noon. With Aquinas, maybe we need to realize that he's writing, thinking from a more metaphysical, participatory metaphysical understanding. Scotus is working more in a logical register. Would that help to explain the difference? Or what can be said? What should be said?
I don't know. The look, I think I'm sort of probably, to an excess, resistant against all of this. This is the Dominican way. This is the, you know, in a different mood. You catch me in a different mood, I'm happy to make broad generalizations like that. But I worry about them because people start feeling like then they have to do that. So you're like, wow, I'm a Franciscan. I better throw in a lot of flower imagery into this theological essay that I'm writing. Or, whoa, I'm a Franciscan, I better not, you know, like, make a distinction because then everybody will think I'm a Dominican. But that's stupid. You should do what you need to do in the task at hand. And you should not let yourself feel pushed into things. Because otherwise it's sort of being driven by things that are extraneous to the task. And I think that's it's kind of important. It's hard for me to shake the feeling that SCOTUS is a very sort of nerdy, logic-oriented guy. I mean, I just have a lot of trouble imagining him, you know, sitting around slapping people on the back. I mean, I have trouble about, I mean, Aquinas is not exactly a barrel of laughs. But, I mean, SCOTUS seems to me even more like that. But I don't know, maybe it's just the way he wrote. I mean, his Latin is famously kind of bad. Occasionally you stumble across an Anglicism, you know, he's trying his best. I mean, maybe that's part of what's driving this. But there is something, he does care about logical points. You know, he's always saying the major premise, the minor premise, proof of the major, proof of the minor. Aquinas doesn't do that too much. He's more relaxed. He's a kind of Italian relaxed guy. And SCOTUS is like a northern uptight guy. But I think that's about them. I don't, you know, so like some Franciscans are like, one way, some Dominicans are like, I don't know, I'm just reluctant to go there.
I'm wondering if I can maybe shift gears a little bit. So we've got four of our speakers in the room here, and I thought I might invite questions that could address any of them, or they could speak sequentially just for a few minutes on the general theme of the conference and maybe some overlap between some of the presentations. You know, so Franciscans and Dominicans, friendly rivals. Is it maybe even the first question to ask, something that sort of came up informally in our conversations, is it even legitimate to say that there is a Franciscan intellectual tradition or a Dominican intellectual tradition? Or is that in a way something we've created in, you know, since Leo the 13th or in modern theology or something like that? Or is that a legitimate expression to what? That's just one first possible question. Does anybody, Dr. Prugel, you've I think had some erudite opinions about this.
I can sort of, may I remain seated?
Yes, you may.
Okay.
We're very informal. We're like, you know,
the
as Dr. Garman was saying.
Of the remain seated. As a historian, I think that intellectual traditions are formed in the classroom rather than in our minds. So the way how we teach, the way how we learn, the way how we interact, that creates traditions. And since the Dominicans had their lecture rooms and their studio, and the Franciscans had their studio, this was the setting of formation, which is very formative. And then, of course, we have textbooks, and Dominicans chose Dominican textbooks and Franciscans chose Franciscan textbooks when they had them. But if we go into the first century, the 13th century, I was, you know, when I listened to your talk, it occurred to me that Alexander of Hales, very famous Franciscan theologian, would solve the problem completely differently. And he he's among those who discovered, it occurred earlier, but he discovered for our context, Cedar Dionysius. And he had beautiful words to say about the power of metaphorical language, and saying if we use for mysteries that are hard to express in logical terms, if we use metaphors, and very simple metaphors, that causes something in our mind which would be like a second logic or like a second language, unspoken. If I compare God to a stone, I'm offended because God is not a stone. So the image, the metaphor, causes something in my understanding which I'm not able to express by words. I think Pseudo-Dionysius was very, very important for this particular question, yeah. But that doesn't solve the problem you're speaking about. Dionysius was hailed in both traditions. It became a common authority. I think that the traditions start with the schools. I wonder what Thomas Aquinas had said about knowing that he'd become the school authority in the 14th century, and what Scotus had said, knowing that he became the school authority in later centuries. It would be interesting.
You feel free to contribute or not if you don't.
I'll try to contribute.
Yeah.
On this particular point. On the question of whether there is a Franciscan intellectual tradition, whether there is a Dominican intellectual tradition, it occurs to me that in my experience in the academy, Franciscans don't really talk about an intellectual tradition. They talk about their great sources. So they'll talk about Bonaventure, they'll talk about Scotus. They won't talk about how they did theology and philosophy for centuries. Today they seem to have kind of set that aside. But I think the important thing is, in addition to getting the specifics of the different schools correct, is to look at those schools that can be, that are really talking about the same thing, but for various reasons approaching it with somewhat different language, somewhat different metaphors, somewhat different thought systems, but that can be rivals. They're talking essentially about the same thing, and they are asking questions and posing problems and organizing theology and philosophy in such a way that you can say, oh, there is something similar going on. And you can get an insight into what the whole of the Christian tradition is doing by looking at what these two traditions are doing in light of each other. I do think that's an important task.
Is there another question someone wants to pose along these lines of the sort of general theme of the conference before we?
I think Greg just put his finger on something I think that we must never lose sight of. I was once asked by a Lutheran, who was a colleague of mine, what is the Catholic doctrine on justification? And I stepped back a second and I thought to myself, well, we don't have one, right? And that's one of the points about the Catholic approach, right? We have many church doctors. We have many church fathers. And they don't, essentially, get along on all points. And I think this is crucial to what we are, isn't it? We don't think we have a final answer. And isn't the whole point about, no, I don't think we do think that, right? And maybe you'll disagree with me, and then you're just proving my point. Which is fine.
One must distinguish.
I
we have to agree upon the things that are taught by revelation.
Well, that's what
And we can legitimately disagree upon the things that are simply theological, permissible theological differences. But in between them, there are those things that we are reaching for in theology that are things that have to be held in order to hold the doctrines of the faith. To be known magisterially, that's an activity of the magisterium. And the magisterium can teach these things authoritatively. But theologians are trying to reach towards them. And a lot, and some things that we do in theology and philosophy are indeed arguments about you can't think this way, even if it's not a matter of de fide definitions, right? So I think that talking about the different schools is in part a way of zeroing in on what, in fact, is the material of that these things have to be held.
I agree with that. I just want to add a complication. I don't have a very good example, which is unfortunate, but I have a bad example. But I think it's relevant to this question of getting traditions to talk to one another and have productive arguments with one another, which is just this. Let's focus on those things in the middle where it's necessary to, you know, so there's certain doctrine, right? It's de fide, everybody has to hold it. And then, you know, let's say I say, well, you have to hold a certain view in order for the doctrine also to be true. And then you hold a different view. Now, what I could do right away is say, aha, you're a heretic. But what I should really do is slow down and ask you, how do you reconcile that with the doctrine that we agree on? Now, what's almost surely the case, assuming I'm being fairly logical, if I held your thing instead of my thing and combined it with all the other 3 million things that I hold, it would be a heresy. The thing is, you probably don't disagree with me on one point. You probably disagree with me on 6 points. And it's the combination of all those things that you end up avoiding the heresy, but in a different way. So the example I have, the not good example, is you're a Thomist and you read Scotus and he says that by virtue of being human, Christ acquires esse simpliciter, and you go, oh my gosh, that's Nestorianism, right? Because, and what you really mean is, if I, as a Thomist, were to say that, I would be a Nestorian. But if actually, when Scotus says esse simpliciter, he doesn't mean the same thing Aquinas does. He's got a different set of distinctions, and so he ends up in the same place that Aquinas does, even though in one way, they seem to disagree. So I'm not shooting down what you're saying. I'm just adding this as a complication. I think it's just something we commonly see in disputes. You take one thing that the other person says and stick it into your own system and make no other changes and then get angry. But that's not the right way.
Let me complicate your complication and just say, I think I don't disagree with that, but at the same time, it also seems true to me that some systems are better than others.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
And so you will, and sometimes what happens is you begin to change the system, and you think that that change, you know, oh, well, I can work it out. Like, I'm going to still hold on to the truth that the faith requires me to profess, and I think I can still hold on to that. In my system, I think my system can still find a way to hold on to that. But in fact, I might be wrong about that, but I just haven't figured it all out.
Absolutely.
And in fact, the piece I took out now, or the piece I changed, is going to end up breaking the system, which I do think does happen with some regularity. So that's one of the things that I like about Aquinas, is I think actually his whole system in general holds together quite well, and other systems I'm less convinced of. Of course, that's an opinion and very debatable by many, but...
Thank you very much for this discussion, and I'm thinking more about this idea that in terms of application of the Fernley rivalry for today, how it said, well, perhaps with Bronner and von Balthasar, it's not a Fernley rivalry, but then in terms of Franciscans and Dominicans, a Fernley rivalry. One idea is in terms of thinking about end, running toward an end, run so as to win. Another idea is in terms of an enemy. So with a rivalry, you have some opposition, but with a friendly rivalry, there's actually perhaps some other opposition. such as Dr. Gorman mentioned, the heresy.
Right.
Okay. So this is where, in terms of some enemy out there, or earlier in a discussion after Dr. Gribble's talk, in terms of the distinction between the Franciscans and Dominicans on the same side and the Dominican controversies against the seculars, to a particular strand of Franciscanism about poverty that that was identified as an enemy, actually. Okay, so in terms of just in terms of putting these together, that sometimes you need a common enemy to have a friendly rivalry. All right, so you know that then you're not the same. You know, Franciscans and Dominicans are twin orders, but we're not identical twins.
Right.
All right. So then to think about what's the common enemy today, and how could there be Franciscans and Dominicans, you know, doing theology as friendly rivals today, because we're both concerned about common enemies.
Mm-hmm.
To quote the Psalms, I'm surrounded by enemies on every side. I don't know, there's just one. I think maybe it's time for us to conclude. Let me just say one final word before thanking everyone. And that is just that the part of the genesis of this conference actually came out of a discussion after a previous conference where, and it was really Dr. Milanave's idea that maybe we would do a conference along these lines. In part because, as the expression goes, steel sharpens steel, and it's very important for any intellectual tradition, I think especially in the Catholic Church, to have people who are friendly but also oppositional on certain points, that it helps you, it's a kind of check and keeps you honest, and also really helps the discussion go forward, it seems to me. At least in my own personal life, I felt like that's sometimes the most fruitful knowledge comes from arguments, and it's good to have these arguments, especially when it's done in the right spirit and out of love of the truth. So that's really what we were aiming at, and what I think it's necessary for us as the Thomistic Institute to also have interlocutors who are not Thomists, but we want them to be friendly interlocutors and friendly exchanges, and we really appreciate that. So to have other traditions like the Franciscan intellectual tradition, insofar as we can say that. That's a gain for us, too, if we want to be good Thomists. So anyway, that's just my final word on that. Let me now ask you to... let me thank all of you for being a part of this conference. I hope that you'll come back to our future events. And let's thank our speakers for the marvelous presentation.